Inside Crime is brought to you by Deterra. The Deterra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to dispose of unused or expired medication. Learn more at deterrasystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with Deterra. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. With this podcast, I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. This season of Inside Crime is all about heroes and survivors. In our last two episodes, you heard incredible stories from two law enforcement heroes who both stress the importance of never giving up. Today, we introduce you to a woman who makes that part of her message, too, when she educates children about the dangers of cybercrime. Alisa Kosakiewicz was 13 years old when she survived the unthinkable. You have been telling your story for many years now, and I know you do it because you want to make the world a better place. But there's nothing to be taken for granted. I can only imagine it's a hard story for you to tell.
It is hard, and people say that to me a lot. This must be really hard for you. And it really is. It can be very difficult. It's emotionally draining. And it is going back to that place. People say, oh, you're reliving it. And yes, in many ways, I am. But I'm doing that so that others don't ever have to live it, so that they can be safe.
How do you start off telling your story when you give your speeches and you go out and you talk to different groups of people?
I very plainly say, my name's Alisa, and I'm here to save your life. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I do is I show a picture of myself at 13 years old. What it shows is me sitting at my computer at 13 years old, and it really is a capture of the times. So there I am sitting in front of my desktop. I'm talking to somebody online who may very well be the predator. I am wearing the same clothes that I was abducted in, and it was taken about 2 weeks before my abduction. And if you were to see this photo, you would see that it is a happy, just a kid. I was a very typical average child, and it's so important to note that this can happen to absolutely any child and to any family. It doesn't matter the circumstances or where you grow up or how much money your family, none of that matters. This was back in 2002, and it was really the start of the internet entering the home. And I can remember I was one of the last of my friends to get online, and the reason that I got online is to maintain those friendships. If I didn't, I wouldn't have been able to talk to my friends. They no longer wanted to go to the park or the mall or the movies. They wanted to stay indoors and stay online.
That was probably around that transition time, like you said.
And this was before we had mobile devices. So mm-hmm. If you were online, you were at home on a desktop with dial-up. So I felt very safe. I was, like I said, a typical child. And in that vein, I was also very shy. And I think a lot of kids are shy. And I was the kid who wasn't overly confident, who didn't raise their hand in class, who didn't speak up. And online, I was able to express myself and to be creative and to be me in ways that I didn't quite feel like I could in person, which today we realize is such a usual thing. That's not a foreign concept at all. But back then it kind of was.
And back then there were no stories, because there was nothing to warn us about internet danger, right? Because it wasn't quite happening yet.
Right. There wasn't anything. And most importantly, I felt so safe. My mom was there. My dad was there. My brother was there. My dog was there.
Because you're in your own home.
I'm in my home and nothing and no one could hurt me here. And nothing and no one ever did and nothing and no one ever could. Mm-hmm. I was safe. And my family thought I was safe. The computer was in a family room and...
She's right there.
Right. And so there weren't any warning signs. There wasn't anything to go off of. And so I started to spend a lot of time online. And a big reason for this was because that's where the kids were. Sure. That's what we did after school. The internet had become the great leveler. The popular kids talked to the not so popular kids and everybody really got along. And it felt like this giant treehouse that our parents couldn't get into. And it's not that we were doing anything wrong, but this was our secret safe place to be kids. I started to spend a lot of time online and some time in chat rooms. And through the process of being introduced through friends, through friends, through friends, I was introduced to the person who would later abduct me. Mm-hmm. And at first, it seemed that this was just a typical average teenage boy. And what I didn't know was that he had immediately begun to groom me. And grooming is so very simple. It's just pretending to be a child's friend and telling them what they want to hear versus what they need to hear.
What they want to hear, exactly.
He made me feel beautiful and important and special and unique. And he was there for me no matter what, telling me again what I wanted to hear and making me feel good about myself, which is exactly what it sounds like a friend would do. A friend is there for you. They make you feel good about yourself. They support you. And so,
and that's exactly what grooming is.
Exactly. This was a fake friendship. And it's not hard to do that online. I knew that there were bad, evil people in the world. I watched the news every so often, or my parents had it on, but that was elsewhere. That sure. wasn't in my safe little circle. So I was completely blindsided. And this grooming process went on for 8 or 9 months, which
Wow, 8 or 9 months.
Yeah, it's quite a long time. These predators take their time. They will talk to a child for weeks, months, years, and sometimes it can happen overnight, and most times it is a very subtle, slow seduction process. And when I say seduction, I don't necessarily mean a sexual seduction or a romantic seduction. Right. It's just a seduction.
Yeah.
It's a luring in. And that's why they call it internet luring. I was being lured and I didn't know.
And your family didn't know. Your parents didn't know. Nobody knew.
No. Okay. If my parents had any inkling,
yeah,
that computer would have been in the yard so quickly.
And so did he eventually say, let's meet, or?
He did. And I agreed to meet him. It was New Year's Day 2002, and we were having a family meal welcoming in the new year. It's a tradition that we had done every year. I asked my mother if I could be excused from the table, and she said yes. And in her mind, I went upstairs to lie down because I said that I had a stomach ache. And instead, I slipped out of the front door, past the Christmas tree, and into the coldest, darkest, iciest night that you can imagine. Now, to tell you how effective grooming is, I was a child who was scared of the dark, hated the cold with a passion, and never went outside alone after dark. But yet, on this night, I walked out of my front door into darkness, into the coldest night, and I didn't take a coat. And I left the door open because I was planning on coming right back through it.
You were just going to pop out and say hello to
exactly.
your friend and then come back in?
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. exactly what I was going to say. I was just going to pop outside, say hello, and come back in. Was that a good decision? No. Was that a smart decision? No. Was it a mistake? Yes. But children make mistakes. An adult should never take advantage of or exploit those mistakes.
And I guess your point about going outside and it being so cold and you not ever really going out alone like that, I think your point in that was that the grooming was so strong that you went against your basic character, right?
That's exactly what grooming is. It's essentially, it's very much like brainwashing. It takes apart who you are and transforms it, and it does it so subtly. And when it comes to a child and they're in a growing process, and over a period of time, if you can get in there, you could really morph who they are and their values. And like you said, their character, that's a great word to use, because this was something so completely out of my character. And looking back, it's something that I still, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. It was me, but it wasn't me.
Well, you know, I think you're 13 and you were excited to meet your friend.
Exactly.
So you're caught up in the moment. So now you're outside, it's cold, and you think it's going to just be a quick second and you'll slip back in and nobody will ever know.
I remember being very cold and looking at the Christmas lights and the snow. It was so quiet. And in that quiet moment, I heard my intuition. And when I speak, it's something that I ask everybody to teach the people in their lives that they care about, to listen to your intuition, because it is there for a reason. Mine spoke up too late. If it spoke up before I walked out of the door, this wouldn't have happened to me. But it spoke up too late. So there I was standing there. There was nobody there. It was quiet. And I heard that voice. And it said, "Alicia, go home." And I was only about a block from my house. I could see it. So I went to turn around. And I heard my name being called. And next thing I knew, I was in a car. And this man was squeezing my hand so tightly that I thought it was broken. And he was threatening me and barking commands at me and telling me that if I did not behave, he was going to put me in the trunk. And he reached back and he showed me that there was a bag full of things to do horrible things to me. And people ask me, "When did you know you were in danger?" And it was at that moment, immediately, I knew that I was no longer in control of my life. And I was in a desperate situation where every moment counted and every action of mine counted. And he started to drive. And I didn't know what to think. Was he going to stop? Was he going to pull over? Was this some sort of sick joke?
Joke? Yeah.
Exactly. He started to drive. And the road signs, I studied them. And at first it was easy because that was my neighborhood. And then I didn't recognize them. And he continued to drive and drive and drive. And eventually he hit a toll booth. And I had this immense, great feeling of hope that he was going to get to this toll booth and the person inside would see me crying and that they would be alerted and it would all be over. And he threatened me before getting to the toll booth, but he couldn't stop my tears. And I said, "Okay, well, this person has to notice these tears." And the car pulled up to the toll booth, the money was exchanged, and the gate went up and he continued on. And I lost,
oh my God,
a lot of hope in that moment. I realized that there's nothing I really can do. In a movie, I would try to jump out of the car, or there's all these things that people try to imagine as if this were a movie, but it wasn't a movie. This was real life. And my goal was to stay alive. And I knew that I was walking a very thin, fine line of survival.
Did you have any idea where you were going or what he was going to do? I mean, or maybe you don't even remember, but at some point you get to your destination, right? I mean,
I remember the sound of the car stopping. For some reason, this is so into my head, that sound. And he got out of the car and he dragged me inside. And he pulled me down a flight of stairs that seemed to go on forever. And I call it a descent into hell. And it's really what it felt like. And you know what? That's kind of what it was. He'd gotten to the bottom of the stairs, holding me. And There was a door with a padlock on it. He unlocked it, pushed me inside, following after, picked me up like I weighed absolutely nothing, and I pretty much didn't weigh much at all, and propped me on this table like I was just this little rag doll. And he forced me to look at him, and it was dark. But there was enough light in the room that I could see him enough. Mm-hmm. And he forced me to look at him, and he said, "This is going to be really hard for you. It's okay to cry." And then he turned on the light. And the room was covered in all sorts of devices to torture somebody. It was a dungeon. It was somewhere to torture somebody. And I knew that that somebody was me. And at that point, he wanted me to break down. And I remember thinking that I so badly wanted to, that I felt like this was a moment where I wanted to claw his eyes out. But I knew that that is exactly what he wanted, and I didn't want to play into that game. After that, he put a locking dog collar around my neck with another padlock.
That's just to back up. That's so interesting you say that, Alicia, because it's almost like even at that moment, you, whatever power you had, you did not want to give in to that. Like,
exactly.
It's almost like, yeah, that's.
I had very little power, and I did not want to give it up. And I realized very quickly that this was as much as something I needed to physically survive as well as mentally survive. And to do that, I was going to have to play a psychological game.
And you're 13 years old.
It's amazing what your body and mind will do. And people say that a lot. You have no idea what you're capable of. And you really don't until you're in a situation where your instinct is all that's speaking for you. It's incredible. And my instincts kicked in and it said, you need to survive and you need to stay alive long enough for somebody to come find you. And I knew that my parents were looking for me because they loved me. And I really had this belief that my parents were superheroes, and I still do in some ways, but like truly superheroes. And they were going to do whatever was necessary to find me, but would they find me in time? So I needed to stay alive. And over those next few days, I was raped and beaten and tortured. He had broken my nose and he didn't feed me. My goal, though, I'd read somewhere or I heard something somewhere, I saw it on TV, I don't know, but this is one of the instincts that kicked in, is that you need to humanize yourself. It will make it harder for him to kill you. Make yourself seem like a person because he sees you as an object. And that was going through my mind.
That's what you were thinking while this was happening?
Yes. And I did whatever I had to do to survive, no matter how humiliating or brutal or disgusting. I did it because I knew that the moment I wasn't of use to him, he was going to kill me. And I also knew that that was the only option, that he could not drop me off somewhere with a blindfold and say, go home. He couldn't say, don't tell your mother. There wasn't a situation where I could say, I'm not going to tell anybody. Again, that's a movie thing. Those are all movie things. And so this wasn't a movie. I knew he was going to kill me.
You knew he was going to kill you because, like you said, after you were, if at some point you were no use to him, it's not like he could, you know, give you back to your family. That's what you were saying earlier.
Exactly. This isn't a situation where he had another option that would keep him from getting into trouble with the law. That was the only option. And I needed to stay away from that possibility as long as possible. There's no words to explain that kind of fear, and thinking every moment you're going to die. And not only are you going to die, but he's going to torture you to death. This is what he enjoys doing. This is not going to be a peaceful death.
As he had already been torturing you.
Exactly. So in so many situations where a child has been abducted, these children are threatened horribly. And then maybe they get a little bit more freedom. And people say, well, why didn't they try to run away, or why didn't they try to escape? The fact is that this person has already hurt you. They've already tortured you. They've already terrified you. Killing you is not that difficult. It just hasn't happened yet. So you listen and you believe them. If they say that they're going to hurt your family, you believe them because they hurt you.
Yeah. Did you have any sense of time while this is happening at all?
Very little. I could see at some points when I wasn't in the basement, I was chained to the floor in his bedroom, and there was a small window, and I could see outside, or not outside, but that there was light coming in. So there were passings of days, but there was no way to really tell how much time had passed. And for me, it was a lifetime.
Yeah. And what happens at the end of 4 days?
The moment came when I was without a doubt that he was going to kill me soon. He said, I'm beginning to like you too much. Tonight we're going to go for a ride. And I feel that humanizing myself was becoming too effective. And he was going to have to end it more quickly than he had anticipated. And he was going to kill me that day. So he said that, and then he fed me for the first time. And I really felt like this is my last meal. And then he left for work. It is amazing the questions that people will ask you when you are a victim in a situation, and certainly when it comes to sexual assault. Why didn't you try to jump out of a window? Why didn't you scream? Why all these things that people think that they would do if they were in that situation? Don't ever ask. Because that person did whatever they needed to survive. And if they're here, then that was exactly what they needed to do.
Yeah.
For me, I was terrified. And he had played disgusting mind games. And I believed that if I had screamed and he had heard it, he would come kill me. I did not know if he had left for work. I could not be sure of that. So I sat quietly and I prayed, and I really prayed, and I thought about my family. And like I said, I knew they were looking for me and that they loved me and that they would find me. And I decided in that moment that I was going to do anything to get away, that I was going to risk my life, that I was going to fight him. And for this moment, I had this rush of hope that I could do this. And then I very quickly realized that that's not going to work. I tried that. He'd overcome me. He broke my nose in one of those struggles. I was going to lose. There's no way that I could fight my way out of this. And I started to have self-talk about my family in a very different way. When was the last time I told my mom, dad, or brother that I loved them? And like, I really love you. And did they know that I loved them and that I was okay? and I was going to be okay. And by that, I don't mean that I was obviously in the best state, but that I was going to accept what was going to happen and that I wanted them to be okay with that. And I really started to accept my own death. And not in a peaceful way by any means, but a hopeless, broken way. And I drifted off, and time passed, and I was brought back to awareness by these voices. They sounded angry, and they were screaming something about having a gun or something, and they sounded scary. And at this point, I had been chained to the floor in his bedroom, and the door that they were banging on was downstairs. I heard the door fall in, and these people, it sounded like they were tearing apart this house. And in my mind, I thought they were coming to kill me.
Oh my gosh, he's got people. They're back.
That's what I thought. I thought that he'd sent people to kill me. And I was terrified.
Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to get rid of unused or expired medication. The DoTerra pouch makes addictive drugs like opioids unusable in minutes. Just place the medication in the pouch and mix with water. Be a part of America's solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at DoTerraSystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with DoTerra.
And these people, it sounded like they were tearing apart this house. And in my mind, I thought they were coming to kill me.
Oh my gosh, he's got people. They're back.
That's what I thought. I thought that he'd sent people to kill me. And I was terrified. And I must have made some sort of noise because I heard this man's voice say, "Movement over there." And I watched those boots, one set of them, walk from one side of the bed to the side that I was hiding under. And he demanded in this gruff voice that I crawl out and put my hands up. And I remember crawling out from underneath this bed, dragging that heavy chain behind me and trying to cover myself because I wasn't giving any clothing to wear, and putting my hands up at the same time and staring into the barrel of a gun and thinking that this is it. This is the moment I'm going to die. And then he turned around, and I saw that it was law enforcement by what was written on the back of his jacket. And I didn't believe it at first. I thought, okay, this is another mind game. This isn't real. And it took some time for it to become real. And then when they physically, they got, I believe they're called jaws of life, but these giant scissors that cut metal, they cut that chain for around my neck, and they walked me out of that house. They gave me a second chance at life, and I'm so lucky to be here. My rescue, I've been told, was 1,000,000 to 1. One of the largest parts of me being rescued was that missing poster created by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I firmly believe that poster was not out there, I would not be here. And the reason for that is because before he had abducted me, he had been talking to another guy online about abducting a young girl. And I think to this other person, it wasn't real. It was fantasy. It wouldn't really happen. Mm-hmm. And so on New Year's Day 2002, he messaged the same person and said, "I got one in Pittsburgh. I'm going to get her handcuffs ready." So he had that little information about Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Once he had me, he was live streaming what he was doing to me to other people online. And this same person was part of this and viewing it.
It was like a group live streaming type of thing.
Yes. So he was broadcasting it. And I believe that this person in that moment realized that their life is now in peril and that they're going to get in quite a bit of trouble. and terrified, they went and looked through the papers and looked online, and they were able to find my missing poster. And this man was able to recognize the little girl in this horrendous, disgusting video as the little girl on the missing poster. And it led to my rescue. It was essentially one horrible person coming forward about another twisted, horrible person. It was nothing short of a miracle. And when law enforcement got into the house, it was around like 4:15 in the early evening, and he was due to arrive home at 4:30. And I believe that if they had a flat tire, or if when they got that tipster call and ignored it, or whatever, anything, I would not be here.
Yeah.
I am so very lucky.
The man who abducted you had talked about abducting a child, a girl of his own, right?
Right.
And he had said that to another man. So fast forward, you're kidnapped, you're in his dungeon, and he's live streaming what's happening with you. That same man who your kidnapper had been talking to earlier recognized you?
From my missing poster, yes.
And then that man called police.
Right.
But when he called police, he did not necessarily have the true identity of your kidnapper.
He had very little information. But one of the things he did have was one of the screen names that the predator was using. And he was able to be tracked down through his IP address.
Got it. So because of his information, investigators were able to track you down.
Exactly.
And if he, I guess the point is, if he did not come forward, who knows what would have happened?
Right. I have mixed feelings about this person because he was involved. I'm grateful for what he did. And he was a bad person doing the right thing.
He did it to save himself. And
exactly.
He did not want to be affiliated with your kidnapper at any point if it was ever found out that he knew.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and then, so it was 4 days and you were rescued and reunited with your family.
Amazing moment. There's no words to describe the sort of fear and terror I felt. And then there's no words to describe the sort of joy I felt when it was over. It was certain death. And then being in my family's arms, there's no words that are adequate to describe that moment of the nightmare is over. And when I knew it was over was when my dad hugged me.
Yeah.
Nothing could hurt me ever again because my dad wouldn't let anything hurt me again. And that was when the nightmare was over.
The fact that you take this horrible thing that happened and you're doing your best to make it into something positive for other people is really, really incredible. And I know you were 13 when this happened, and it wasn't long before you were telling your story and speaking out to help other people, right?
I was
14 or 15?
I was 14. I was very shy, but I knew it was so important. And the reason it was so important is because after this happened, it seemed like the world went mad. They were blaming the victim. They couldn't understand how something like this could happen. And there was still no internet safety education. And adults weren't talking about it. And I saw kids that I knew, friends of mine, were meeting people off of the internet. And I knew that this was going to go somewhere and it was only going to get worse.
So in other words, after what happened to you, you saw that mistakes were still happening with your friends in your community.
Absolutely. People were still making mistakes. I remember when I did my first presentation, I was so freaked out and so nervous. I thought, wow, this isn't going to be effective at all. And it was, even though I don't know if I uttered an intelligible word, it was so effective because what the kids saw was my pain. I was sharing something genuine with them. This was real life. And they got that. And they got how painful and serious it was. And that was a huge turning point for me. I know for a fact that I have made a difference. And that is something that's incredible. To take what happened and to give it a purpose. If we work hard, if we have hope, if we have faith, if we work on moving forward, we can find a purpose in the chaos. And that's what I've been able to do, is to take this horrible, awful, disgusting thing that happened to me and give it a purpose. And that purpose is to save other kids. People will say to me a lot, they'll say, I'm so sorry that happened to you, and they'll get very sad. And I say, so much good has come from it. So much, so much good. And one of those is Alicia's Law, which is my namesake, and it has passed in 11 states. And what it does is it helps to fund the Internet Crimes Against Children task forces that helped to rescue me. It provides a dedicated revenue stream. I have had law enforcement officers, ICAC agents, hold my hand and cry tears of joy because now they could do their work. And before, their hands were tied and they couldn't rescue these children because there wasn't funding.
Yeah.
And on my website, if you were to go to it, you would see a map. And what this map is it's a map of the United States, and it's blanketed in these red dots. And what these red dots signify are clusters of computers that are downloading and trading and uploading sadistic, graphic child sex abuse material. Now, this map, it's a map. There's dots on it. 55% of those dots are hands-on offenders with a local child victim. Those are real children who are being hurt. And not all of these kids have been kidnapped or abducted. In fact, very few of them are, because statistically, that's not how child sexual abuse happens. It happens most frequently in the home or where the child should feel safe and loved and protected, and by those who should be loving and protecting the child. So a family member, an uncle, cousin, whoever who's close to the child. So we have an eye into this and we can rescue these children. And this is so personal to me, not just because the part of the story that I've told you, but another part. So at some point between my rescue and the trial, law enforcement came to my house. I think I was 16 years old. And they said, we need you to identify yourself in something. And they sat down and they opened up the computer. And very clearly, there was me, with my hands bound above my head, in that basement, crying, bleeding, begging, bruised, bloody, me. Me being tortured, and to experience something like that is one thing, but to witness it through the eyes of the person who's committing that atrocity upon you is something entirely different. And I had heard how I was rescued, that he had broadcast it, this video, or that he had live streamed it. I heard that and I understood it, but it didn't sink into what that really meant. And that this video of me in it was being used for other people's pleasure, and that there are so many children. There are popular collections that kids are getting notification. In fact, they're not even kids, they're adults now. It's been 20 years and they're still getting notifications in the mail that the video that they are in has popped up in a court case.
In a trial or something.
In some ways, you are forever being abused.
Re-victimized.
Absolutely. And in that moment,
endlessly.
I was so re-victimized. Yes. And I have never received one of those notifications, and for that, I am so grateful. But when I look at that map, I know that those kids are real kids, just like I was, and they need rescue. And like I said, every child deserves rescue. And if that funding isn't there, they can't be rescued. So the funding provides training, boots on the ground, resources, real money for real children to be rescued. Now, one of the places that has worked with Alicia's Law incredibly well is Wisconsin. They have done so much. They have caught 1,000 predators in the 2 years since it passed. And just recently, and this is one of the things I'm most proud about, and I have a smile from ear to ear right now thinking about it, but they brought in a new officer, and what he is he's actually a canine. He's electronic sniffing canine. And what these dogs are able to do, and there's only a handful of them in the country, but what they're able to do is sniff out and find electronic material, so electronic devices. And they're able to go into a home or business or wherever and find it, very much in the same way that they're able to find drugs or bombs. And what they did was they named this dog Kozak after me. So there is this crime-fighting superhero dog that is going out there and sniffing out electronic devices, putting horrible people behind bars, saving children, and then comforting the victims, and also being a part of trainings. It's incredible.
So awesome. How are you doing these days?
I really appreciate you asking that. Sometimes people will ask that at the end, or they won't ask it at all. Right. And I'm just the story, and we are so much more than our stories. And I'm doing incredibly well. I'm really very happy and really enjoying my life, and I'm grateful for every moment. I am now married to an incredible, handsome, wonderful man who is supportive of me and my mission and my goals and of just everything Alicia comes up with. And I now have my master's degree in forensic psychology. And I'm also working on, or my speech has really changed over the years into being primarily educational to much more motivational. And that has been a really fun, wonderful shift that I get to share positivity and overcoming adversity, just instead of just this horrible thing can happen to you, right. Don't let it happen to you.
Right.
Because horrible things do happen. They right. happen to all of us, and we have to find a way through it somehow.
Well, that's a very important message, Alicia. Hopefully people will hear about this and contact you and get some of your advice and learn from your experience.
I want to do as much as I can, and I'm always looking to do more.
We're so grateful to you and for sharing your story and for coming on Inside Crime. So thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
Best of luck to you, Alicia.
And that's it for this edition of Inside Crime. Check out our website for more information about our podcast. That's insidecrime.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.